Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, June 10th. Currently 50 degrees here in Old Town Park City and 55 degrees in the Heber Valley, again under mostly sunny skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Wednesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Wednesday. Happy hump day to you. We've got lots of sunshine out there from start to finish today. It's going to be a beautiful looking day. Now, there is a disturbance that's going to pass by to our north and east today, not bringing us any rain chances, but what it will do, it will bring a surge of wind our way, especially as we go into the afternoon hour. So we'll notice those winds picking up anywhere between 20 to 30 miles per hour out of the west and northwest, and we'll see some gusts at times that could get up to 40 miles. So be aware of the gusty winds with the sunshine also could lead to a little bit of an elevated fire danger threat for us once again as we go into this afternoon. High temperatures will struggle to reach the 70 degree mark in Park City with highs in the upper 70s for us in the Heber Valley. It gets a bit interesting as we go into your forecast for tonight. Wednesday night will feature clear skies. We're going to see light winds out there, and we're going to see some of the cooler temperatures settling back into the northern half of the state. So, yes, I think across most of the Wasatch back, we're going to see our temperatures dipping down into the mid to upper 30s. Wouldn't be surprised to see a couple of places flirting with the freezing mark by early Thursday morning. So be aware of that. Definitely a chilly start to the day, considering now that we are in the second half of June almost. Now, as we go into the afternoon on Thursday, it will turn out to be another spectacular day with lots of sunshine. We'll see those temperatures climbing back near 70 in Park City with highs back into the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. Moving into your Friday, we're going to see a ridge of high pressure taking over and starting to build in from the west. So that's going to start the warming trend. We'll jump about 10 degrees for those high temperatures in Park City with those highs going from near 70 to highs climbing to around 80 degrees for our Friday into Saturday. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we'll see those temperatures going from the mid-70s into the upper 80s for your Friday and Saturday. Again, lots of sunshine expected heading into the weekend. We'll get a little warmer going into your Sunday with low 80s for the Heber Valley, mid-70s for Park City. And then we'll see those numbers staying in the 70s in Park City and 80s in the Heber Valley through next week with dry conditions and sunshine. That's a good latest forecast for the Wasatch back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned in just a minute. We'll be checking in with Park City Manager Adam Lenhardt and Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden with a preview of this week's City Council meeting. Later on, I'll be talking with the director of the film The Lake, Abby Ellis, with details about an upcoming screening to support Utah's Grow the Flow. Finally, Heber Valley Chamber Public Relations Manager Jessica Turner with a preview of a number of upcoming events. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include linguist Valerie Friedland, author of Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. Then, as Utah heads into peak sunshine season, local dermatologist Karen Stolman talks about skin cancer risk in our high-altitude state and the simple steps you can take to protect your skin all summer long. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life, heard, of course, every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Residents once again challenging Park City's decision to grant lift upgrades at its namesake ski resort. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports their appeals echoes an earlier legal dispute.
Six Park City area residents are appealing the Silverlode Express Eagle and Eaglet lift replacements. They claim the upgrades will add to overcrowding and dangerous conditions at Park City Mountain. The Park City Planning Commission approved the upgrades May 27th. The residents filed their appeal with Park City Municipal June 8th. The appellants say commissioners ignored testimony about potential safety hazards. A city hearing officer will decide whether to reverse the approvals. Park City Mountain's vice president and COO, Deidre Walsh, said in a statement June 9th the process had been, quote, rigorous and transparent. The appellants include Frody Jensen, Catherine Jensen, and Alan Theus of Park City. Marvin Kabotznik, Andrea Griffiths, and Alan Inglis live in the Snyderville Basin. Frody Jensen, Kabotznik, Griffiths, and Inglis all submitted sworn statements to the Planning Commission, attesting to unsafe or overcrowded conditions on terrain serviced by Silverlode or Eagle. Their appeal says the Planning Commission unlawfully ignored that evidence. For Jensen, what goes up must come down.
We think that increased lift capacity inevitably leads to increased downhill crowding, and we think that's a detrimental impact, that it has ramifications for safety and for customer enjoyment and a good experience. And we think under the code, the Planning Commission should have looked at those impacts.
Jensen adds that all the appellants are in favor of the new lifts. They're asking the hearing officer to send the issue back to the Planning Commission for a more thorough review. The appeal says the commissioners didn't factor in Park City Mountain's internal calculations regarding how many skiers and riders the mountain can manage. That's called the resort's comfortable carrying capacity. And Park City Mountain has never made it public, arguing that it's proprietary. The CCC figured prominently in Park City Mountain's first attempt to upgrade Silverload, Eagle, and Eaglet in 2022. Four other residents eventually overturned the planning department's initial approval of those upgrades. This time around, the resort didn't provide the Planning Commission with information about its comfortable carrying capacity. Park City Mountain went through a different planning process this year than it did 4 years ago. Jensen and the other residents believe the resort should have still submitted its CCC calculations, despite City Attorney Mark Harrington saying it didn't need to. The previous residents' appeal kickstarted 3 years of litigation. Park City Municipal and Vail Resorts Epic Promise Foundation are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Park City Council meets in a regular meeting tomorrow starting at 5:30. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, City Manager Adam Lenhart along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Heather, let's just start with the story we just ran. Residents, as we reported, filed another appeal against Park City Mountain's chairlift approval. As we heard in the story, City Attorney Mark Harrington says that the applicant didn't need to provide traffic numbers. The appellants believe the more people you bring on the mountain, the more people you have coming down the mountain, creating unsafe conditions. So I guess why wouldn't that have been a consideration, you know, in requiring those numbers?
That is not part of the requirements for a conditional use permit, which is the permits that Park City Mountain had applied for both the Eagle and Silver Load upgrades. So even though I know some commissioners requested that information, ultimately it wasn't required, but they did consider information that was presented both during a site visit and work session in earlier March and in two public hearings that the Planning Commission had before they issued their decision, as mentioned in the story on May 27th.
So why was it required the first time around?
Because the permits that the Park City Mountain had sought in those earlier submissions exactly were administrative permits as opposed to the conditional use permit.
So why is there, I guess, more of a burden on an administrative permit as opposed to a, you know, conditional use permit, which you would think, you know, has many conditions?
Yes, and that's a good question. I probably am not able to get into the details of that very well, Leslie, without the benefit of my planning director. But I do know that the process is different with conditional use permits.
All right, so how will this be heard? Because it doesn't go to, the appeal doesn't go to City Council, right?
That's correct. The City Council changed the appeal authority through the Land Management Code some time ago. And so now the appeal is heard by the city's land use hearing officer. And that hearing officer was selected through an RFP process. His name is Tim Pack. He's an attorney with Clyde Snow.
Okay, and I guess what sort of training does he have that would make this a, you know, really an investigation? I mean, does he have some qualifications?
Yes, Mr. Pack is a very reputable trial attorney. He also has quite a bit of experience in real estate litigation and land use processes. He's represented both, you know, private litigants as well as governmental entities. And so through that RFP process, he was selected as someone who had the ability and the skills to serve in that capacity.
Didn't we used to have kind of a planning authority board that this would have gone to, and we did away with it? It was like a three-member.
You know what? That's a great question, and it's unfortunately a history I'm not familiar with.
Okay. Let's see. How long will this take? I mean, is there some kind of timeline that Mr. Pack has to get this done?
There is. So there's the next step is for Mr. Pack to set the date for the appeal. And the Land Management Code requires that to, or the Park City Municipal Code rather, requires that to be set within 45 days of the date that the appellants have filed their appeal. So within 45 days of June 8th, unless the appellant and the city agree to a different timeline.
All right. Adam, let's kind of back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the news that the Park City Council may be backing off of its pay raise. I mean, what happened? Whose idea was this?
This was a unanimous decision by the council. Feedback that they provided at last week's council meeting. When the increases were implemented at the end of May, there was significant public feedback, a lot of conversations that were happening online, in the media. I know the council members were having conversations with residents across the city, and a lot of that feedback was critical of the decision that had been made. And so last week in the June 4th council meeting, the mayor and council were unanimous in requesting that staff bring this item back, that we schedule it again for another public discussion so that it could be reconsidered. I think what the council said, if you listen to that meeting, was that they heard the feedback loud and clear, and they understood where the political winds were blowing, and they thought that it would be good to bring it back for additional discussion.
Yeah, so kind of given that the council came forward at last week's meeting unanimously, it sounds like they had made this decision prior to last week's discussion. So how does that work? I mean, council members are free to talk to one another individually as long as three of them aren't on the phone call creating a quorum?
That is correct, yes. In certain matters like land use and some other specifically identified matters that would come before the council, they can engage in what's referred to as ex parte communication. But in a policy decision that's purely legislative, like elected official compensation, they can have those conversations. However, what I would, my observation is that this is a decision I think they all reached independently. There was no formal vote in last week's meeting. So they didn't take a vote or any formal action, but they each had the opportunity to express some comments. And independently, I think that was a decision they had reached and then shared that with staff in the meeting.
Okay, so now what?
Okay, so what we've attempted to do since last Thursday is we're providing a variety of different approaches that the council could use to inform this discussion. We've scheduled additional public comment so the public can come and speak on this issue. The council felt that was important in terms of the overall discussion. So in our staff report, which I would mention to our listeners, those who are interested, we'll have a final version of the staff report later this morning, and that's because we've got some additional information that we feel is relevant to the conversation and that can, again, help inform the overall conversation. And we want that to be thorough. We want it to be comprehensive. And so be on the lookout for that later this morning, the final staff report. But we've attempted to implement a number of different methodologies that the council could look at. Where it gets really tricky is there's no single standardized methodology for implementing council pay. It's entirely a political decision by the council. Ultimately, they have to cast their vote and decide what is both financially feasible, can the budget support it, and then what's politically acceptable. And I think what has been agreed upon so far is that doubling pay was not politically acceptable. So they've shown a willingness to discuss this again, to reconsider. I would expect some adjustment tomorrow. I don't want to speak for them, but that's just based on my conversations. I think, again, what the council has said publicly is that they have heard that feedback and believe that it should be reconsidered.
Okay, I didn't notice it as an agenda item, so it's going to just be part of the council comments?
It did change, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we did update the agenda. We wanted to be very clear that would be a matter that would be discussed separately.
Okay, so how does that work? I mean, was an ordinance approved allowing that, so they kind of revoke an ordinance? Or?
Yeah, the council as a legislative body can amend an ordinance at any time.
Okay, so is the plan then to have this done prior to the start of next fiscal year so that it's included in fiscal year 27 budget?
That is the goal, and ultimately we're planning on a June 25th date for final budget approval. I was going to say the 24th. I wanted to make sure it was 24th or 25th. The final meeting in June is when the budget is anticipated to be adopted, and this would be part of that. So the decision could come tomorrow night. It could also be made on the 25th. I just don't know how that conversation will play out.
Okay. Also, as we've reported, KPCW received a copy of the video of the person, as Councilmember Molly Miller described it, forcibly smacking her at last week's Spring Projects open house. The case, I believe, has been referred to the state attorney general's office. Why there? Why can't Park City Police Department investigate?
That's a great question. The city manager's office, our local police department, all city staff, we directly report to and work very closely with the city council. And to maintain complete impartiality and to avoid even the appearance of local bias or political influence, we don't believe we can handle that internally. And so as a standard administrative protocol, it was referred out immediately. We referred it to the Utah Attorney General's office because their office is designed specifically to handle issues with public officials. They're separated from the local politics, from the regional dynamics, and that makes them the most appropriate entity to handle it. We did very briefly consider Summit County, and that would have been very easy to refer it to them. But again, precisely because we work with them so closely on a daily basis, and there's a lot of that regional collaboration and familiarity, we ultimately decided very quickly just to send it to the Attorney General's office and let them handle it. And that way it stays completely independent and unbiased, and we can get the best outcomes both for Councilmember Miller and for the other individual that's allegedly involved in this.
Yeah, so Councilmember Miller said that she isn't going to press charges, so why is an investigation done?
That's entirely up to the Attorney General's office. So for staff, once the incident was reported, the best course of action is to refer it out immediately. What we don't want to do is to be making these independent judgments without a thorough investigation happening. And at the time that it was referred, we were not waiting or asking, you know, are you going to press charges? That's a decision for her to make. She could take her time and change her mind at some point. And so we didn't want to preempt any decision she might make about how she wanted to handle the incident. That's her prerogative. But as soon as we were notified that there was an incident involving a public official, we referred it out immediately, and that was the end of our involvement.
So the Attorney General's office could press charges independently?
I think they could, and I'm sure that they would do that in consultation with Councilmember Miller and her desire whether or not to proceed or do anything further. Would be taken into consideration. They do have independent authority that they could charge without her wanting to do that. I don't know what the outcome has or will be, and we'll allow that process to play out.
Yeah, do we have any idea on a timeline?
I don't.
Okay. And it was difficult to see much on the video. I mean, we saw the person's head in question was cut off, and I guess that tells us that he was tall. So will the city consider upgrading its video cameras, just since the video wasn't that helpful?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I actually saw the video for the first time probably at the same time that most of our residents saw it. We had multiple grammar requests for that video, and I believe it was probably Monday that KPCW posted the video. That was the first time I saw it, and I think I had the reaction that many people did, that, wow, we don't have cameras with better resolution. It was hard to tell what was going on. So yeah, good question about the videos and, you know, their resolution. We're gonna have to look at that.
All right. Heather, also on the agenda, we've got a couple of planning commission appointments. There were three openings. This council appointed Adam Strong earlier this spring, so we've got those two others open?
That's right. The City Council will be appointing two members to the Planning Commission for four-year terms. We had eight applicants, one withdrew, and then the seven applicants that remained were interviewed by the council. And so now they will, this will come before the council tomorrow evening with the two members to be appointed by the mayor with the advice and consent of the City Council.
So have they been identified, who these two new ones are?
They have not yet. Mm. I think the mayor is in discussion with the City Council members, and we will learn that this evening during their discussion.
All right. Wanted to mention quick, as part of the budget discussion, I mean, there's a arts and culture planner position that I think is some kind of partnership with the Park City and Summit County?
That's right.
Arts Council?
Yes, yeah. We've received a request from the Park City and Summit County Arts Council to help fund a new position that would be entirely designed to implement their new arts and culture master plan. And what that request consists of is a $65,000 request from the city, and then another $65,000 to be matched by Summit County. Now, we're a little bit out of sync in terms of the timing of the budgets because our budget year begins July 1, the county's is on a calendar year. So In tomorrow night's meeting, the council is going to review the proposed job description for this position. The council wanted to look at the duties that are being assigned to this position. How does it help implement that master plan? Is it meeting the goals that we have for our community? And then any funding there would likely be contingent upon the county later at its own discretion choosing to fund the other half of that position.
Mm-hmm. So is to implement the plan, I mean, once that's done, the job's over, or is it somebody that would maintain, I guess, the objectives of the plan?
Yes, this is likely a multi-year permanent position that would have to be refunded from year to year. The Arts and Culture Master Plan is a comprehensive document. There's a lot of things that have been identified in that plan that can be done in our community over the next few years, and so it is a multi-year effort.
Yeah, so why do you think it's important that this position get funded? It wouldn't have gone this far unless you thought it was worth funding, yeah?
Right. I think arts and culture play such a huge role in our community. It's certainly something that I think many of our tourists and visitors here are interested in. Whether it's, you know, visiting a private art gallery or catching a show or a concert, or the, you know, just enjoying the variety of public art that we have throughout our community, and we see opportunities to further enhance that. Those types of things can really bring significant upgrades to quality of life, to the overall visitor experience, and I think they're worth doing, and the council expressed support for this in the discussion last week.
Okay, was there anything else on the agenda that you wanted to make sure that people knew about?
4th of July.
4th of July.
Okay, so we've got parade applications, I know, due in a bit.
Yes, June 14th.
Okay, so that's coming right up.
It is.
Yeah. Well, so off the agenda then, Heather, can you give us any updates on what's going on with the Bonanza 5 acres? It sounds like it's headed to Planning Commission?
It is. We have our first Planning Commission meeting tentatively set for June 24th. That's going to be a site visit and a work session with the Planning Commission. And because it's a work session, it is not a hearing where they're inviting public input on that, but there will be opportunities in the future to provide public input. And just so that listeners are aware, we do have a website up that discusses a lot of the details of where we're at with the 5 acre site. And that website is actually 5acresite.com. That's the number 5acresite.com. It has the most up-to-date information about the site. It is going to be a working website where we're updating it as we go through the Planning Commission process. So we have the land use process that is proceeding. And then our developer will also be back before the City Council to come in this summer and throughout the year as we discuss the development agreements with our private partner, both GTS and Brinshore Development. And there will be opportunities during those meetings as well for public input. And once we have those scheduled, we will be sure to let you know.
All right. And then what about the Clark Ranch? Any updates there? I know that density was decreased a bit ago.
That's correct. The Alexander Company has submitted some revised plans based upon the feedback they received from the Joint Planning and City Council work session in February. Those revisions do reduce density from 201 units down to 164, drops the building height down to 35 feet, and it separates the longer buildings into 10 separate multi-unit buildings. And that's going to come before the Planning Commission actually on Wednesday for just some high-level conceptual input on that general design before they continue to proceed through the land use approval process.
All right. And then what's the latest with regard to the Park Meadows bike and pedestrian project? Again, we had some citizen criticism about putting everybody on the same path.
That's right. We've had a lot of input on that, and we really appreciate that and have incorporated that public input into some new potential designs for Little Kate. That pathway project is going to be, we're going to have another open house at the Mark on June 23rd from 5 to 6:30 p.m. with some different alternative concepts. And these all keep bicyclists and pedestrians separated. So we're hoping that the public will come out, give us some further feedback on those potential options, and then we'll be coming back before the council with those as well.
Okay. And Adam, the final budget approval happens in a couple weeks?
That's correct, on the 25th.
All right. You're just going to be reviewing it one more time?
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Anything else, guys?
I think that's it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Park City Manager Adam Lenhard, along with Deputy City Manager Heather Snedden. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. On the phone with an update on the film since we last talked to her in January is the film's director, Abby Ellis. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning.
So for listeners who may not know the film yet, talk to us a little bit about what The Lake is about and what drew you to the story.
Yeah, so the film is about an environmental nuclear bomb here in Utah, known as the Great Salt Lake, which is drying up. And the lake bed is full of toxic materials such as arsenic and lead and other material that we don't even know yet. The film follows a handful of people from science to politics working to not only better understand this crisis, but also how they can stop it before it takes off.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about that. I mean, why is the lake's future such an urgent issue now? And as we just see less and less water going into it, is that why this is becoming such an environmental disaster?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that I think is actually fairly encouraging about this monumental problem is it's mostly human caused, right? It's exacerbated by climate change, but the number one driver for this is human consumption and mismanagement of this precious resource. So you've got, you know, agriculture uses a significant amount of water, municipalities use a significant amount of water, as well as industries across the state. So it's not that their water use has increased necessarily, though some buckets of that have. It's more just that we've been using, you know, significant water that otherwise would get to the lake. We've been diverting it for our own use now for so long that it's having a pretty dramatic impact.
Mm-hmm. Are there misconceptions that people have about the Great Salt Lake and the decline there?
I'm not sure. I think it's hard for me to say because I know too much about it, but I think people may assume that the Great Salt Lake has nothing to do with them and doesn't affect their life. And I'm here to say it affects every aspect of our lives. It's the air that we breathe. It's the food that we eat. It's the water we drink. It's our businesses and our real estate. So if we want Utah to survive and we want to live here, we have to save the lake.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you were filming the lake today, would there be any new scenes, stories, or developments that you would want to include?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I think I don't know that much has happened that would translate on screen as, you know, significant, but a lot is happening behind the scenes. We're seeing significant dollars get raised for lake conservation, which is really exciting. And I think the population is starting to get a bit more engaged on the issue as well.
Yeah, can you talk any more about that, just about maybe how state policies or conservation efforts have made you a little bit perhaps more hopeful or maybe more concerned?
Yeah, the film, at least I know of the film's impact, and it has garnered pretty significant donations to Great Salt Lake Rising, which is an organization dedicated to really putting water back in the lake. And so I'm hopeful that what we've been dealing with in terms of apathy hasn't been actual apathy. It's just been a lack of information. And the more information that people here in Utah have, the faster we can get to the finish line of really turning this around.
Mm-hmm. This free screening benefits Go With The Flow, that organization. Do you have any idea how that organization's mission connects with the themes of your film?
Definitely. So Ben Abbott is an ecologist and professor at BYU. He's featured in our film, and he is also the executive director of Grow The Flow. Grow The Flow does an incredible job of organizing at the local level and working during the legislative session to get people engaged and to get politicians engaged on the issue. And they are teaming up with us for this screening June 22nd and will be there to participate and provide any sort of educational material or, you know, information and participate in Q&As and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. I thought I heard that the screening has been sold out. Do you have any updates on that?
I believe you are right that the screening has been sold out, but we do have a screening July 18th. It's a Saturday at the Utah Film Center that will also have a Q&A afterwards, and then another one July 19th at the Park City Library. And we are in the process of launching an impact campaign. So our goal is to get the film at 100 venues across the state. So this is when I ask your listeners for help. If anyone is interested in hosting a screening or getting it into their, you know, institution, corporation, anything like that, we would love to hear from you and collaborate, because we just want to get this in front of as many eyes as possible.
Yeah. So is that where the film is kind of like living now, and just these small screenings?
Yeah. So right now we're doing an impact campaign, and the film will most likely be on air available to everyone this January.
Okay. Like on Netflix or something like that, or PBS?
Yeah, we're in the process of finalizing those negotiations, so I can't tell you exactly where it will land, but as soon as we can, we'll upload that to our website and make it available for everybody.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about this impact fund. That's being done with you personally or with the Grow the Flow organization?
Yeah, so our impact campaign, it's typical usually after you premiere a film at a festival, you launch an impact campaign so that more people can get access to the film, because it's this moment where the film's not yet sold, but everyone saw news about it and they want to watch it, and we want people to watch it, especially in this case, given the impact it can have. So we are, with our production company and Grow the Flow helping as well, we are hoping to screen the film like 100 times in different places across the state. We're hoping that school districts want to incorporate it into their curriculum. We're hoping businesses want to host screenings to, you know, get more people on board and talk more about, you know, donations and just really rally the community, because, you know, there's a lot of money that does need to be raised. There's also a lot of stuff that average people can do to help reduce their footprint when it comes to the lake. And I think that that's really important.
Yeah. One of the film's major players, Brian Steed, has since resigned from his job. He was one of those on the Great Salt Lake Commission. I'm just curious. I'm sure you've talked with him. Did that have anything to do with him appearing in your film, or?
Oh, no, not at all. I think Brian felt great about the way that his work came off in the film. I think that he's one of these guys who's like, I always tell him, he's the smartest, most educated guy I know in the state, and I think maybe they wanted him in a different position. I know he'll still be working on this behind the scenes and helping to advise who takes his place. You know, there are a lot of really smart and engaged people in government around this issue, so I don't think they're going to have any issue replacing him. Brian also lives in Logan, and that's, you know, pretty far from Salt Lake, which is where the commissioner's office is sort of headquartered. So it was definitely more personal decisions than anything else.
Mm-hmm. The lake seems to be a real success, and how your storytelling and film helped build public and political support. I mean, did you have any indication that documentaries like this can actually help do that?
I will say it's why you get into this work, to have some sort of impact, but I've never made a film that's had such measurable impact at such an early point in its life. And I really do credit, I don't know, just, you know, the special nature of Utah and the fact that I think, you know, you actually can reach people on the other side of the political spectrum, and people can come together and unite around something like the environment. I think it's very cool, especially given the political climate nationally, where you don't really feel like you can have an impact at all. So I was really, you know, pleasantly surprised, and it's like invigorated me and made me more excited about my next film, and, you know, kind of instilled a sense of optimism that I think left everyone working in film and journalism for a little while.
Yeah. And I know you're a new mom, but you did mention perhaps a new project. What are you thinking about?
Yes. I am working on a new film about the end of the world, but it's not as dark as it sounds. It's going to be somewhat of a comedy, but it, like The Lake, follows a brilliant scientist out of the University of Chicago whose job it is to calculate how close we are to midnight, which is their code for the end of the world.
How far along are you with that?
We are in development now, so hopefully we will move into production in the fall.
Okay, well, good luck with the Lake making it onto our national screens. And anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's all. Thank you guys so much for having me and continuing to engage on this.
You bet. That's Abby Ellis, the director of the film The Lake. Again, the free in-person screening of The Lake is set for the Eccles Center on Monday, the 22nd, at 7 p.m. Again, it is a sold-out screening. I don't know what to tell you other than that if you're very interested in watching it, maybe you line up as part of a wait list. But as she mentioned, a couple of other screenings happening on July 18th at the Utah Film Center, as well as July 19th at the Park City Library Santee Auditorium. A Summit County Health Department survey found suicide is the second leading cause of death among local boys and men ages 10 to 40. KPCW's Sydney Weaver reports that data is being shared as the county recognizes Men's Health Month.
Summit County Health Director Phil Bondurant says the early 2026 survey found men are suffering with significant mental and behavioral health challenges between the ages of 10 and 44. In the U.S., Bondurant says suicide is the second leading cause of death behind unintentional injury.
It's the eighth leading cause of death nationally across all ages of men. When we look at this in Utah, we are two times the national average in suicides. And when you look at men, three of the four suicides in the state of Utah are men.
He says that's disproportionate to women. Roughly 31 out of 100,000 suicide deaths in Utah are men, while less than 9 deaths per 100,000 are women. Bondurant says those statistics are related to men feeling isolated, experiencing depression, and uncertainty about the future. But he says the health department has worked to develop programs to break the stigma around men's mental health and help people access care.
It's important that we remember that connection, conversation, you know, help and support, just like our physical health. When we're not feeling well or we break a bone, we go to the doctor and they do what they do to help us get better and help our bodies mend. Our mental health is the same way. We need to take care of it.
He says uninsured residents that need help can call the health department and speak with their behavioral health team. There's also a 24-hour 988 crisis hotline for people who need help or know someone who needs it. Utahns can also download the Safe Utah app to speak with licensed counselors, submit safety tips, and for confidential help. Links to resources are available at kpcw.org. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
On the phone now, with an update of some community events happening in Wasatch County, I have Heber Valley Chamber's Public Relations Manager, Jessica Turner. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Leslie. Pleasure to be on the program this morning.
Yeah. So let's start. And I saw this earlier, and it may be even too late, but the North Pole Express train tickets are on sale, and I know those are a hot commodity.
They sure are. Yeah, they went on sale starting on Monday, and as has been the case in the past, unfortunately, the website did crash on Monday because of the influx and unexpected throngs of people that ended up visiting the website to buy those tickets. So I will say that the team over at the Heber Valley Railroad has been working ferociously and diligently to make sure that that site is up and running. There are still tickets available. I will say if you're looking to do the North Pole Express this November or December, you will want to get those tickets sooner rather than later. They anticipate being sold out by July or August. You do have the option of getting on a wait list after that, but it's pretty bleak outlook if you don't get those tickets secured early in advance. So, yeah, now is the time.
Okay, and also it sounds like coming up is the Demolition Derby and rodeo tickets that'll be on sale. But this is not done online.
Yeah, this year, and they actually started this last year, so this will be the second, maybe even the third year that they've done this. They offer an in-person ticket sale opportunity before the online tickets go to the public. So this Friday and Saturday at the Wasatch County Parks and Rec location, they will offer in-person ticket sales. They do offer early ticket sales for county employees, so I do understand that some people get a bit frustrated with the process. because when you do go in to buy them, when they open to the public, some tickets are not available for certain seating sections. And that's just a perk of being a county employee. So that helps explain some of the mystique behind that. But yeah, the Demolition Derby will be, this year will be July 23rd, 24th, 25th. The Wasatch Stampede Rodeo will be July 30th and 31st and August 1st. So they bookend our annual county fair days. The county fair will be earlier this year than it has in past years. That's just based on the way the calendar rotates. So this year's county fair days will be July 27th through August 1st. So if you're looking to go to either the Demolition Derby at the end of July or the Wasatch Stampede Rodeo, you're going to want to try and get those tickets in advance as well. They do sell out, particularly Friday and Saturday nights. So it's a three-day demo derby and a three-day rodeo.
So the in-person part, is that right to try and reduce just scalpers buying up
the
tickets?
It sure is. Yep, exactly, Leslie. Yeah, they are doing what they can to try and reduce fraudulent ticket sales as well as scalpers. So if you do go and buy those in person, you're more likely to get the seats you want, ensure you're getting actual accurate tickets direct from the vendor. They have had issues in the most recent years with people showing up saying they have tickets, but they're actually fraudulent tickets and they've spent the money and then can't get into the event. So it's best to buy direct or at least validate if you are buying from a third party, validate that they are valid tickets.
All right. What else you got going on?
So just a few noteworthy events that are happening across Wasatch County. Our beautiful folklore bookshop over in Midway, off Midway Main Street, is hosting a Utah Local Author Day. It's the first time they've done this. This will be on Friday, June 12th from 5 to 7. They're going to have several local authors that they'll be featuring, highlighting at this two-hour event. It's free to come, walk through, meet these local authors, and see their different works that contribute, you know, to the bookshop there. Then on June 20th, coming up, is the annual Jordan L Triathlon. I mentioned that for a couple of reasons. One, just to be aware that right around Jordan L Reservoir will be a huge number of athletes and support crew and volunteers on that Saturday, June 20th. So if you're participating or want to volunteer, you prepare now. If you're not, maybe make alternative plans for that area of the valley and the Wasatch back. Also on June 20th at Soldier Hollow is the annual Wasatch 50 mountain bike race. So excited to see Soldier Hollow's gearing up for summer season with a lot of mountain bike and trail race competitions and activities over there. Toward the end of the month is the Antique Power Show. Now, this is held at a private estate over in Wallsburg, which is on the far south end of Wasatch County. Richard W. Erickson is a pretty well-known name throughout the area. He opens, well, the family and the foundation opens that private property. They have about 25 huge shops that they have antiques cars, classic cars, tributes to pioneer lifestyle, a lot of antiques that you can go see up close that you don't get access to any other time of the year. That's going to be a three-day event happening June 26th through the 28th. You can and should get tickets in advance. They do offer a lot of other activities on site for that Saturday if you're trying to determine which of those days. So they'll have some model planes out and food trucks, live music, things of that nature to make it more of a festival environment that weekend.
It's so cool. I would tell people, make sure you don't miss it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I've been to it the last couple of years and I've taken family and friends and everyone's always impressed at just the sheer size of the buildings and everything they have in them. So, and then a couple other quick things. Soldier Hollow will have its annual Mountain Bike Fest happening that same weekend, June 26th through 28th. Of course, Heber Valley Artisan Cheese does monthly cheese making classes for mozzarella and burrata and once a month cheese tasting as well. The annual Back to the 50s car show will be returning to Heber City Park on June 27th. That's a full day event, free for anybody that wants to come walk through those cars. The Plain Air Paradise event is returning to the Midway Town Square June 30th, and it'll culminate July 4th. So that's part of leading into the Red, White, and Blue Festival that's happening across the valley. I know Park City has a very dialed in July 4th parade and festivities happening as well. So I'll just highlight a couple things happening here on July 4th, just to put it on everyone's radar that's out there listening. The 5K and 10K races will be kicking off at 7 a.m. We have several free activities throughout the day, happening mostly at Heber City Park, some over at Midway Town Square. The biggie for us is going to be the Utah Symphony. They will be performing a free concert at Midway Town Square the night of July 4th, followed by fireworks. So really excited to welcome the Utah Symphony over to our little town of Midway and excited to hear what they have to play. Then a couple other things, Deer Creek Trail Half Marathon coming July 11th, and then TED Fest, another big music festival in Wallsburg out at the Erickson Foundation property July 17th through the 19th. So that's just a few things happening. Of course, the full calendar of events on our website at GoHeberValley.com.
Okay, and we know that the Thursday Heber Market Series has started and continues every Thursday.
It has kicked off.
5 to 9.
Yes, indeed. In fact, tomorrow, if you're looking for which Thursday to attend, tomorrow might just be the signature Thursday, because we are doing, the Heber Valley Chamber is hosting our annual ice cream social. We will have 21 local business partners handing out free toppings. We will be handing out complimentary Rooney's ice cream cups. So Rooney's is a local small batch ice cream manufacturer based here in Heber City. And all of that is free. We'll be there from 5 until the ice cream runs out, which is usually around 8, 8:30. So if you are in the area or looking to attend that Heber market, make sure to put tomorrow, June 11th, on your calendar.
Okay.
Couple other chamber things that are coming up that are noteworthy too include our next business mixer, which will be at the hospital, Heber Valley Hospital, June 17th, 4 to 6. That is free, and you do not have to be there the entire time. We just ask that you register in advance for the complimentary food and beverages that will be offered. It's a great opportunity to mix, mingle, meet, greet, and network with other business owners and operators throughout the valley, and to say hello to us as a chamber here in Heber Valley. And then Jordan Ridge, they've got a new barn and cafe. They're hosting a grand opening for that new addition up in that Jordan Ridge area on June 20th from 10 to 2, if you're interested in stopping over there. Homestead Golf Course. So we have a couple of golf updates. Many of you out there who are avid golfers or are just local to the area already know Homestead Golf Course is closed for the season. And they, as of now, will still be operating that golf course. However, it will be opening in 2027 as a private course. So historically a public course, it will be shifting to a private course starting in 2027. However, we do have a new golf opportunity that has just opened up in the Valley, Sky Ridge. So their par one golf course is open now. They've got 15 golf bays, which is kind of a top golf style that will be open this fall. So the golf bays are not yet open. They're working on that clubhouse and finishing that. We took a hard hat tour of that earlier this week, and I gotta say it's pretty impressive space. They're gonna have 2 to 3 dining outlets that will be open to the public. The golf is open to the public currently, and the golf bays will also be open to the public when they open in the fall. So losing Homestead but adding in Sky Ridge, great location right there, adjacent to the Jordanelle and the Mayflower development area of Deer Valley East Village, if you're curious where that is. Our historic Avon Theater has got a big facelift. A local family purchased that theater a few years ago and has been slowly remodeling the interior. So they're holding a grand opening of that theater on June 27th in the evening. Our chamber, a couple things to put out there, more of a put on your radar and save the dates, is our annual chamber golf tournament will be held at Soldier Hollow on the Gold Course. A lot of people look forward to this tournament each year. So it will be happening August 11th, standard 8 a.m. shotgun start like we always do. If you are looking to play as a single or a team, please get registered now. We've only got a few spots left. It fills up quickly. We are still looking for any kind of support there if anyone's interested in being boots on the ground day of, either in a volunteer capacity or sponsorship opportunity. The biggie this year will be the Utah Tourism Conference. This is a mega tourism conference held throughout the state of Utah that several organizations and representatives even outside the state will participate, including Utah Office of Tourism's reps that are international. They will fly in for this full conference. It's going to be held here in Wasatch County. We're really looking forward to welcoming it back. I believe it was about a decade ago that we held the conference at Zermatt. This year, it will be October 13th through the 16th. So a little bit later in fall, and it will be held at Grand Hyatt Deer Valley. Tickets are on sale now for that conference if anyone's looking or interested in attending the conference. Also, Grand Hyatt has offered a very generous discounted rate for rooms during that time. We will be finalizing the schedule, speakers, topics, breakouts, as well as activities, all of that in the works now. So secure your ticket for the conference, secure your room if you're wanting to stay at Grand Hyatt, especially for a discounted rate, and this would be the opportunity to do that.
Okay. Hey, thanks so much, Jessica.
Thank you.
Jessica Turner, again, is the Public Relations Manager for Heber Valley Chamber. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Corey Richens, who killed her husband with a lethal dose of fentanyl, is appealing her March murder conviction to Utah's highest courts. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
Utah Supreme Court records show attorneys for Corey Richens filed a notice appealing her aggravated murder conviction May 26th. The case was referred to the Utah Court of Appeals the following day. A Summit County jury found Richens guilty of poisoning her husband Eric Richens with a fatal dose of fentanyl in 2022 for financial gain. She would go on to write a children's book about grief. The Camas mother of three was also convicted of attempted aggravated murder, forgery, and two counts of insurance fraud March 16th. Third District Judge Richard Mrazek sentenced Richens to life in prison without the possibility of parole May 13th. The seven-member Court of Appeals will consider whether there are grounds to overturn her conviction on any of the five charges. Their decision would not turn on trial evidence or witness testimony, but on whether the trial court correctly conducted the case. Summit County is on the hook for Richens' attorney fees during the appeal because it's an aggravated murder case. It applied for state funding, but Deputy County Manager Jana Young tells KPCW the state declined to cover appellate costs earlier in June. She called it, quote, unfortunate news for us and our taxpayers. Summit County spent millions on the murder trial since Richens was unable to pay for her own defense. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.